had a little trouble with relationships. That's that is the understatement of this day, I'll tell you what. And some work difficulties. That's a kind of a understatement too. What a great friend to have, and what a great introduction. Thank you, Bill. I want to thank the committee for asking me to do this, and for asking me to do the little bit I did yesterday afternoon on the history of AA and history of the big book, and I enjoy being with you. I have friends here that I've known for a long, long time, some new friends I've made this weekend, and I appreciate that. I love you people, and I love this program. My name is Dick Wright, and I'm a real alcoholic. And I'm a real alcoholic, Ken, because not to separate myself or differentiate myself from you at all, except that I didn't have difficulty with some of the other things that we have difficulty with today. I was what the book calls and what Ken referred to last night as a pure alcoholic. I just had trouble with alcohol, and so you can, that's not to separate me or distinguish me from anybody else. That was my only trouble, was alcohol. Well, I had some other troubles, but not mood change. Well, they did change my mood, but my problem was alcohol. And I tell you this not to differentiate myself from it, but because you can read about me in this book. You can read about what it was like, what the disease was that I suffered from, about why I couldn't drink successfully and why I couldn't quit successfully. And you can find out what happened to me that great day when I was introduced to this program in a classic textbook 12-step call, and how I've been able to access some ideas to recover since that time and to have that spiritual experience that I'm promised I'll have in step 12 if I work these steps. Read about it in here. I brought this book only to, I'll talk about this book from time to time. I hope you got one if you're alcoholic. If you're not alcoholic and you got an alcoholic, I hope you got one, okay? Because this is the owner's manual. This is the operator's manual. There's two parts in this book, okay? A black part and a white part. If I talk about this book this morning, I'm going to talk about the black part. Before I knew anything about alcoholism and anything about recovery, I obviously would focus in on the white part of the book. And after I got real sober 3 or 4 months, the gray part. But I'll talk, if I can, about any part, it'll be the black part. Get some statistics out of the way. I was born living on a farm in the Finger Lakes region of upstate New York. I was born on August 19th, 1930. So for those of you that aren't quick in math, I'll be 56. I'm a member in good standing of the Indian Trail Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is a southern suburbs of Charlotte, and I've been a member of that group for a long time, ever since I've lived there. And when I lived here in Stone Mountain, I was a member of the Memorial Drive Beginners Group, and that was my home group. I moved here from Greensboro, North Carolina in 1980, and my home group there was the Lawndale group, and it was always my home group. I had one sponsor in Greensboro. I had one sponsor when I lived here, and I've had one sponsor since I moved back to Charlotte. Now, I only tell you this because there seems to be in my life at least some sanctity about the preservation of home group affiliation and sponsorship affiliation. And I treasure those relationships, and I've appreciated the sanctity of them, and I've tried to maintain them. I took my last drink on October 17th, 1965. So that, you got any math? Bill beat me last night in the countdown. I got beat out by Bill, but that's fine. Bill, congratulations on 51 years. That's great. Good to be in your presence. My story goes like this. I was raised in this little country village in upstate New York on the farm. You know, when I was born in 1930, the heels of the Depression, country atmosphere, little village called Fosterville. Nobody knows that. I got a t-shirt that says, born in Fosterville, New York. Nobody knows where that is. But our farm was kind of up on a hill, and you look down over this little village, and probably 150, 200 people, if you swung a circle around a half a mile, and most of them were farmers. And there was a one-room schoolhouse there that I went to. There was a church steeple where most everyone went to church. And if you can see this kind of pastoral setting, you'll understand that it was filled with good people and good standards and good code of conduct. And I learned good things, tight control of my life by these people and by the standards and by my dad. And life went along pretty well. I would like to tell you that I was a victim, you know, that I got mistreated, that I didn't learn, I didn't hear about the good things, I didn't know about good people, that I was a victim. And I found out that I am a victim. And I found that out in this book, in the black part of the book. I'm a victim of selfishness and self-centeredness and strong self-will. That's what I was a victim of. I didn't have that for a while. As I look back on my life, and I can see these formative years in this little village with these people, I can see that everything went real well, as long as I was under the influence and control of those things. And they taught me good things, and they exposed me good things, and there was a lot of love, and I learned a good work ethic, and I didn't have any trouble. But I reached a point, I'm not sure when that was, my young teenage years, when I wasn't too pleased with those things. I didn't like the control, and I didn't like the influence, I didn't like the standards, and I wasn't too fond of the people. And so I began to make my own rules, my own code of conduct, and a different set of friends, and a different set of standards. And I didn't find out what that was until after you folks had me read part of this book in the black part, where it says that I developed self-will. I didn't know I had it before. I thought it was my dad's will. I thought it was this little community's will. I thought it was good standards. I thought it was good people. That was the will. But I found out I had my own self-will. And it says in here that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success, because in that condition I'm almost always in conflict. And I began to be in conflict. Immediately, serious conflict. And I had conflict with my dad, and I had conflict with bus drivers, I had conflict with teachers, with the school administration, with law enforcement people, with other people in this community. I began to be in conflict and have trouble getting along. Now, Dr. Silkworth, in the doctor's opinion, describes to a T with three words how my life began to be, what it began to be like. That I began to be restless, irritable, and discontented because of that self-will and because of the conflicts that I was in. And I went on into life restless, irritable, and discontent. And one night I was with some guys that were older than I was. I'd been walking up to a drive-in theater on the main highway, and sitting out there against the old fallen down apple tree in a neighbor's lot watching the movies when they had loudspeakers on the screen before they even had the things you put in your car window. And we had to walk by a couple of places on the way up there. One of them was called Jake's and the other one was called a Rainbow Inn. And these guys began to stop at the Rainbow Inn on the way up there, and they'd buy something, take it up with them, and I'd observe them. And I saw that they were having a better time than I was, and something was influencing this, and something was stimulating this. And so I didn't ask any questions. I just kind of observed, and I picked up on it. And one night, I had I'd stashed away 86 cents. And I put it in my overalls pocket, and I went up there. When they stopped in the Rainbow Inn, I stopped in with them, and I got a quart of Roma port wine for 86 cents. And I pulled my T-shirt out of my overall, and I put that down inside there, and pulled my T-shirt out over, walked up to the drive-in theater, sat down against that old falling-down apple tree with those guys in the goldenrod and the weeds, and took the cap off of that and began to drink it. Drank it all. I don't have to tell you I had a bad night. I expect I threw that cap away when I screwed it off there. Bob and I, my friend Bob, I've known Bob for 39 years. He and I have had a great relationship, and I'm glad he's here today. I appreciate he and two of his three boys are here, and I've known him a long time. But Bob and I were in some business relationships where they'd take that cork thing and they'd take the cork out of the top of the wine bottle and they'd feel the cork, you know, smell it, pour a little bit in a glass and swirl it around, look at it, sip it, nod their head to the waiter. Never heard anybody say, that's terrible. But Bob and I left one of these entertainment settings, one business entertainment setting one night, and he says, that's amazing. He said, I used to take the cap off of it, throw it out the car window. But I sat out there and I drank that quart of Roman port wine. I had a bad night. And I rolled around in the weeds and the dirt a lot. And I puked a lot. I've heard people say they got nauseous. I never got nauseous. But I puked a lot, folks. I hadn't done that. You know, I'd gotten over that. I hadn't done that. I wet my pants. I hadn't done that in a long time. It's amazing. And I went home that night in that old farmhouse and that upstairs bed, and that stuff kept on all night long. And so there was a lot of stuff to have to fix up the next morning. And my mother was sad, and my sister was bewildered, and my dad was mad. And I had to clean up that I had to clean that wreckage up. And I began to be what all alcoholics need to be, good fixer up. I learned that then. And as I look back on that, with all that, I finally worked my way out of that situation. But let me tell you what happened as I reflect on that. Remember, I'm restless, irritable, and discontent because of self-will. And I'm in conflict with other people. And sometime between the time I took the cap off of that, and between then and the time I started to roll around in the dirt and puke and wet my pants, I passed through a little period of time in there when my life was a whole lot better. The black part of the book calls a sense of ease and comfort. And I know what that means, a sense of ease and comfort. And I experienced that. And the hard work and the dirt and the sweat and the cow manure and the chicken manure and the gathering eggs and the pigs, they didn't seem to make much difference. That was okay. I was funnier. I was wittier with this group I was with. I could dream about how great things were going to be when I got out of this situation and got out on my own and was able to execute on these new rules and these new standards. Little period of time. And I carried this information on into life with me. Restless, irritable, and discontent, but I knew something that'd make me feel better. That's a bad combination, I found out. Finally got through high school, went on into college, got almost a college education. January 1951, during the Korean War, I was going to be drafted. I had put an application in for pilot training program in the Air Force. I enlisted the day before I got my draft notice because we had some communication with the county draft board. I enlisted in the Air Force, and I was in the Air Force nearly 11 years. And I... A lot of things happened there, and that, a lot of my story is there, and I'll go right through it because you understand the story. You understand what happened. I got in pilot training program, got commissioned, got my wings, flew airplanes in the Strategic Air Command mostly during the Cold War period, because the Korean War the truce was in late 1953, but I stayed in there a long time, and a long time for me, almost 11 years. A lot of good things happened to me. First day of the World Series, 1953, I went to Tampa, Florida, stationed at MacDill Air Force Base, and I met my wife, who's sitting back there, and whom I've been married to for 53 years. Now, that's not a record, but it ain't bad. Ain't bad in AA, I'll tell you that. Pretty darn good. I met her, accorded her, restationed up in the northeastern part of the state of Maine, brought her up there. We were married. We had two little girls born to us while we were there. And on the surface, remember, I'm restless, irritable, and discontent because my life is run on self-will. And things that were important to me had nothing to do with the teachings and the knowledge and the things that I learned in that little village as a youngster. You see, I left all of those back there. I left that church steeple back there. I left those people back there. I left those standards back there. The things that were important to me were things that made me feel good, that made me feel important because of this self-will. I tell this story, and one of the guys I sponsor makes me tell this story, but one day I said, one day I'm going to buzz that little village with an airplane. And so I staged an opportunity one summer afternoon to do that. And I got a 50-mile clearance of the Syracuse Low Frequency Range Station, visual flight rules, waiting to do some night celestial activity or something, and I dropped a 200,000-pound four-engine airplane down over that little village, and I buzzed that thing four times at 300 feet. They loved it. I mean, every time I'd go home, they'd talk about that. Nothing like that ever happened around here before. That was one of the greatest things that ever happened in this little village. I loved it. I loved it. That was my standard. You know, fortunately, my standards have changed now, thanks to you people in this program. I go back now, and every once in a while, somebody will bring it up. I still love it. But see, I wasn't concerned with being a good person. I wasn't concerned with living by these standards that I'd learned there. And I wasn't concerned with being a good husband. I wasn't concerned about being a good pilot. I was concerned about being a good pilot, being a good father. And so my military records looked pretty good. But remember, I'm restless, irritable, and discontent. And I know something that'll fix it, make me feel better. And I used it in excess over and over again. And those little situations that I'd get into, I'd be able to fix up, and I'd get through them, and I'd come out okay on the other side, and I did well. And I had a good record. But something happened. Now, my sponsor, I knew a fella in Greensboro, talk about a roller coaster. Said you go up there, first thing on the roller coaster, clickety-click, 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 get to the top, and the next thing you know, you're at the bottom. And that's what happened to me. Clickety-click, clickety-click, going along, fixing things up, getting in a little trouble, using it to just get that sense of ease and comfort, restless, irritable, and discontent. I'm at the bottom. And I began to get in trouble, and I began not to be able to fix things up, and I began to be unable to quit when I needed to quit and get straightened out to do the things that I was expected to do and to be the aircraft commander that I was supposed to be and the crew member that I was supposed to be and the fellow military person I was supposed to be, and the husband I was supposed to be, and the father I was supposed to be. Couldn't do those things anymore. And my world began to be filled with narrow-minded people. And I don't fault the United States Air Force, because the United States Air Force didn't have any, they didn't know what to do with me. I was a kind of a rare bird. I'm sure I'm not the first alcoholic who'd crossed over that invisible line while I was a member of the military, but I'll tell you, I was a bad case. And they may have had some routine remedies for some people, but their routine remedies didn't work for me, because I represented a seriously bad case for them. And I got hospitalized the first time in 1961, on April 9th, 1961, a base hospital in Ramey Air Force Base in Aguadilla, Puerto Rico. Now, I sponsor guys today that say they had a bad day. Okay. I don't have any bad days anymore. Okay. I can remember what a bad day was like. Let me tell you what a bad day was like. A bad day was on the 9th of April, 1961. Here's how you tell you're having a bad day. You look at the door, and there's no doorknob on the inside. That's going to be a bad day. Now, if you're an alcoholic, you don't pick up on that right away. You know, you don't say it. You don't pick up on that right away. You got to have some other things. You look around, and there's a light that burns all the time, and it's recessed back in the ceiling, and there's a little wire mesh glass over it, security glass. And there's a little window in the door about this big with a security glass wire mesh screen glass in it. And they look in at you. You see them. You see the eyes out there. They're looking in, watching you, see what you're doing. Now, normally, somebody would pick up on that. No doorknob, little glass, people looking in. You see their eyes, going to be a bad day. But don't learn that yet. Over in the corner is a toilet. And you look over there, and you see there's no handle on it. And you don't know why. But somebody tells you if you need to use the toilet, you tell us. So you wave out the door with one of these sets of eyes looking in at you, and you say, need to use the toilet, and they nod their head. And you use the toilet, and you're finished, and you go back over to the eyes, and you say, done. And they flush the toilet from out in the hall, because they don't trust you to flush your own toilet. Now you pick up on the idea that this isn't going to be one of those best days. Now you say, oh, this isn't going to be a good day. Well, there were going to be some of those days that weren't good days. I don't have any bad days. That's a bad day. There were going to be more of those. And I continued to have that kind of difficulty for the rest of 1961. Bob looked at my military records at one time, and I remember him sitting at the kitchen table, 3705 Normandy Road, Greensboro, North Carolina, and he says to me, 1961 wasn't one of your better years, was it? Now, so that you'll understand that I'm not faking this, I thought I'd bring along a document. They put together a board of general officers to determine whether or not I ought to be retained on active duty status in the Air Force. And here's a medical and psychiatric evaluation that was provided that board of general officers. And it says, diagnosis, alcoholism, chronic, severe. So for those of you that are just general, average alcoholic, I'm worse, chronic and severe. Manifested by repeated episodes of prolonged intoxication requiring hospitalization, interfering with his ability to work, stress minimal, chronic marital difficulties, previous stress at work, predisposition, moderate, immature personality with marked dependency needs, impairment severe. This person's drinking problem has greatly interfered with his ability to perform his duties effectively. Recommendations, after a careful review, don't have to give that a careful review, I'll tell you. of this person's past record, and after careful examination, you don't have to do that either, the recommendation is made that Captain Richard W. Wright be separated from the U.S. Air Force under appropriate administrative action. And he attached to that some of the hospitalization. I'll tell you how slow the Air Force was in picking up on this. The first hospitalization was in April of 1961 at Ramey Air Force Base. And diagnosis, observation, psychiatric, drunkenness, simple. I'm not sure what simple drunkenness is. I never experienced simple drunkenness. I was either in business or out of business by this time. Second hospitalization, 2 or 3 weeks later, gastritis, acute. Now, if you drank like I did, you had acute gastritis. This is not a phenomenal diagnosis. History of drinking. June, emotional instability reaction. What a diagnosis for an alcoholic. Emotional instability reaction. That manifested by anxiety, insomnia, heavy alcohol intake. July, a little later, same diagnosis, emotional instability reaction. Finally in September, they get it. Diagnosis, alcoholism, chronic, severe. He'd gone through all this others, nervousness, gastritis, emotional instability reaction twice. Now they finally get it right. Alcoholism, chronic and severe. And I was thrown out of the service in late December 1961 with a general discharge because of that alcoholism, because of my unfitness to continue on as a military member. And I came home and I did what all good 31-year-old married men with children ought to do. Unemployed. I moved in with my mother. I tried to put my life back together, and in the first paragraph of the third chapter, more about alcoholism, it talks about me. It says, because how can you have this kind of stuff in your file, in writing, at your disposal, and not figure out what's wrong? Now, the rest of you that have got to sit back and think, I wonder if I behaved alcoholic, I wonder if I was alcoholic, you got a problem because you got to recall this stuff, not me. All I got to be able to do is read. I can't read, I guess. I don't know, because it talks about me in the first paragraph of chapter 3 when it says about my unwillingness to admit that I was alcoholic in the face of all this information and all this difficulty. And because of that inability to accept that I can't drink like other people, there would be countless vain attempts to prove that I could. And so I repositioned myself in the insurance business. I did all right. I wouldn't drink for a period of time, and there would come an occasion when I'd drink, and by now when I drank, I was out of business. I wasn't marginally functional. I wasn't a little bit socially unacceptable. I was out of business, and there would be periods of that. Countless vain attempts to prove that I could drink like other people and fail every time. Came to Greensboro in 1964, and on the 11th of October, which was a Monday night, I stopped at a place called The Mug in the Lawndale Shopping Center to have a beer, and that's an innocent thing to do. Hadn't had a drink in a while. Don't know why I drank that night. Maybe I had a bad day. Maybe I had an average day. Maybe I had a good day. Well, I was restless, irritable, and discontent, I'll tell you that. And I needed to experience that sense of ease and comfort. And I stopped into The Mug to do that. And on Sunday morning, the 17th of October, I had not been back to work. I had only bathed when necessary. I hadn't eaten much. I was drinking around the clock. I could not get sober. The two little girls who were 8 and 6 at the time were next door and had been there for 2 days, where Barbara wisely put them because I was unfit to be around when I'm in that condition. And on that Sunday morning, I recall, shady as it is, that I was sitting in the corner of the living room in my underwear. Now, Katie said she'd like to see everybody naked or in their underwear, but My sponsor, Bill C., and I had the same trouble. We always ended up in our underwear. And I was sitting there in the corner of the living room in my underwear, and I was drinking out of a quart of White Horse Scotch, I think. Chasing it with Pall Mall cigarettes. Social drinking. Not harming a soul. And I can't tell you what happened that morning. I can tell you this, that I didn't have any pre-announcement. There was not, I'd not received a message that this was going to be a different day, that some things were going to happen that had never happened before, that you're going to be in the same condition you've been many times, but something different is going to happen. Be on the alert. I didn't hear anything like that. As I was sitting there, though, we talk about the moment of truth, and I suspect that that's a good definition of what happened, that moment of truth. As I sat there, I can recall that I saw life in an entirely different, from an entirely different perspective. And it wasn't their fault, and it wasn't her fault, and it wasn't the challenges at work, or child raising, or all of these other things. It was what I was using to solve those feelings. And how I, on my own, had created that difficulty. And how I could not quit on my own. And how I could not drink successfully. And that dawned on me as I was sitting there. And I didn't know what to do. And I didn't know anybody to call. And I waited. It was a Sunday. I gave her the bottle. She put it up. She didn't know what she did with it. I don't know what she did with it. And after we'd become affiliated with a little church because of the children, I didn't need it, obviously. I was grown I was beyond that, certainly. And I didn't know anybody to call except this church. So I gave the minister an opportunity to get home to the parsonage after the service, and I called him. His name was Marion Workman. He's a minister at Mount Pisgah United Methodist Church in Greensboro. And I asked him if I could see him, and he came immediately. And he sat across from me, and for the first time ever, I told somebody the truth about what was going on and what it had done to me and what difficulties it had created. And I was honest with this man for the first time that I had not been honest with military psychiatrists and psychologists and commanders and family members, but I was honest with Mary. And he looked at me with all the compassion and understanding and love that a man of his profession has, and he says, "I can't help you." But he says, "I know some people that can. Will you let me call them?" And I said, "Call them." And he called a man by the name of Boyd Christopher. Boyd is dead now. Boyd was a member of that church. And Boyd got a friend. His name is Wade. Bob knows Wade. Some others who've been around a while know Wade. The two of them came immediately. And they carried a message of hope into a hopeless, despairing, fatal, mortal situation. And we sat in the middle of that living room, and for those of you that had worried, I'd gotten dressed by now, cleaned up a little bit, I wasn't still in my underwear. And these two men told me about feelings that they had felt and thoughts that they had had and drinking escapades that they had been involved in that I thought I was the only one that thought, felt, and drank that way. And one of them hadn't had a drink in 9 years, and the other one in 5 years. And I'd never heard anything like that before. And I was impressed. And I think that afternoon I bought this thing, hook, line, and sinker. I think I bought it hook, line, and sinker. Because of the great hope that these two men brought into that awful situation. Barbara was there, the minister was there, Wade and Boyd. And they, before that night was over, they asked me if I wanted to go to a meeting, and I did, and they took me to Burlington, North Carolina that night because there was a speaker meeting over there. We drove over to Burlington, went to speaker meeting, and for the first time I was introduced to you people, 12 or 15 of you. And I don't remember, I know the speaker was from Danville, Virginia, I don't remember much about what he said, but I remember that they gave out a beginner's chip at the end, and Boyd had put me on the edge. So that I wouldn't have any problem getting out. He was a big man, bigger than me. He nudged me. I went up and got a beginner's chip. And after the meeting, you people came and you shook my hand, and your hand was warm, and I could see the sparkle in your eye and the smile on your face and the earnestness in you. And I knew that you had something I wanted. I knew that these two men had brought it into my life that afternoon, and I knew now I had come to a place where you people gathered and learned about the tools that would permit you to pull that off, and I fell in love with you people right then. You said you understood. No one had understood, but you did. We went back to Greensboro that night, and I made a mistake. So if you're new here, pick up on this. I asked Wade how many meetings I should go to. Now, if you're new, don't ask that question, because that was before the 90 and 90 thing that we got now, you know. Then Wade looked at me and he said that 7 meetings a week would be enough for you. He didn't ask me what my social calendar looked like, how many openings I had. I sponsor guys today, and I say, we talk about going to meetings, and they talk about, we got soccer practice. Wade didn't ask me about soccer practice. 7 meetings a week. The key thing, though, that I remember Wade saying was that I never had a drink again if I didn't want to. And I knew instinctively, sick as I was, incapable as I was of sorting anything like that out, I knew instinctively that as a result of what these two men had brought that afternoon, that hope, and where I had come that night to be with you people, where you folks learned to pull that off, was a powerful combination. And if I drank again, it was because I made a choice to drink, and I had not had that choice in a long, long while. And they took me by the hand, and they led me into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous with you people right from the beginning. They insisted I go to work the next day. Sick as I was, I went to work. They got with me for middle of the forenoon, lunch, middle of the afternoon, met for coffee at Franklin Drugstore in the Lawndale Shopping Center, 5 o'clock, 7:30, horn blowing, went to O. Henry Group. Same thing Tuesday, Open Door Group. Same thing Wednesday, Fisher Park. Thursday, Dogwood. Friday, Lawndale. Saturday, Pepsi. And I started to get comfortable in the fellowship with you people. The power of the fellowship, having shared in a common peril that he talks about in chapter 2, the resolution, how powerful the power of the fellowship is. And I began to feel it right off the bat. And right from the beginning, I wanted to be with you people because I felt safe and I felt comfortable and I knew you understood. And as a powerful, as he said in there, it's a powerful element in the cement which binds us together, and I began to experience it. Now, I'm going to tell you about my early days in AA. I thought back on this because I've been asked to do some workshops and stuff on sponsorship, and I thought about those early days and these sponsors and what they did for me. And they did nothing. They did nothing. Ken talked about it. They didn't do anything. I laugh at people who come to their first AA meeting today. They leave, got a big book, 12 and 12, AA Comes of Age, pass it on, Dr. Bob and a good old timer, thought for the day, daily reflection, 18 pamphlets. These people can barely brush their teeth. And these guys just let me kind of get snuggled in and get nestled in. And that's how I grew in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. After I got snuggled and nestled in and felt good with you people and was hooked into the power of the fellowship, then there came a time when I was able to follow instructions from Wade and start to make an inventory and do other things. And to get that more powerful element in the cement that binds us together, having found a common solution, a deep and effective spiritual experience. I didn't like that. I was hoping it would be something else, change of climate, change of job, something that wasn't that. But that's how I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. That's how I grew in it. It was a long, long while before I began to use the big book, and the big book used with me. It was a long, long while before I began to get into the 12 and 12. I learned, turn GSO off. I learned the steps out of the little red book in a Tuesday night open door meeting in Greensboro, North Carolina. I learned the steps out of the little red book. That's terrible, isn't it? That's sacrilegious, for crying out loud. But that's where I learned the step. And that's how I grew in Alcoholics Anonymous. Folks, I picked up a new guy Monday night. New York City fella. Came to AA 18 years ago. Stayed active in AA for 8 years. Stayed sober. Quit going to meetings for 8 years. Stayed sober. Been drunk for 2 years. Ended up in a rehab facility in Pennsylvania. He asked me to be his sponsor. Typical story. I asked him, where's Jan? I asked her. I asked him the question I always ask people, did you have fun? Was it fun out there? He said, no, it's terrible. I've been waiting all this time for somebody to come back and say, gosh, I had a good time. It was great. And he gave that other universal answer that I always get. I quit going to meetings. So these two men led me on in to the program with you people, and I began to grow in the fellowship, and I began to do the things that Wade told me to do so that I could have that deep and effective spiritual experience, which was the more important element in the cement that would bind me together with you people in the program and a God of my understanding. And I began to do those things, and I made it. Wade was terrible about the decision, about step three. He was bad about that. The only step he knew. Every problem, I'd go with him to him with these monumental difficulties, earth-shattering things, and Wade would say, take step three. I thought that was the only step he knew. But it never dawned on me how wise he was, because he drilled it into me. You see, I think, I talk to guys now that I sponsor, I say, been in the program 6 months, I say, what step are you working on? They say, I'm working on step one. I look at them funny. See, I didn't work on step one in AA, folks. I work on step one out there drinking whiskey. That's where I work on step one. I came to grips with step one, I think, that morning, sitting in that chair drinking out of that quarter scotch. I understood powerlessness and alcoholism and unmanageability. I think I understood about step two when these two men were sitting with me in the living room that afternoon when they told me about feelings they had felt and thoughts that they had thought and drinking behavior that they had done. And I knew instinctively that they had done this with a power greater than themselves. I knew that. And so I think that the same thing happened to me that afternoon that happened to Bill when Ebby's sitting in his kitchen. And he says, why don't you choose your own conception of God? Bill says, it melted the icy intellectual mountain in whose shadow I had stood for years. So I think I had understood and accepted the provisions of step one and step two, and Wade was wise in pounding home step three, and he was wise in telling me that I needed to take an inventory, and I needed to take that inventory and sit down with him and go through it, and that I needed to be entirely ready to have those things removed and humbly ask to have them removed, and I needed to make a list, and I needed to go make amends. And I've done all those things. I've done them well enough. I've all of them up through 8 and 9 well enough so that I can tell you I was talking earlier that I don't know of anything that could happen or anybody who would come into my life that would cause me to have that sinking feeling in my belly. I don't know of anybody that would ring my doorbell and I open the door and they're there that would give me that sinking feeling. that there's unfinished business. I don't know of anybody that I'd meet in the crowd that would give me that feeling. That's because I worked my way up to clearing up the wreckage of the past. I got right with God, I got right with myself, and I got right with the world about me by following the provisions of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous under the teachings of you people and the guidance of you people. Let me tell you, my sponsor says, you're still enthusiastic about AA, aren't you? And I tell him, I am still enthusiastic about AA. I don't go to 7 meetings a week anymore. Okay. I go to 6. I go to 6 because I love to be with you people. Because I feel good still, like I did the first night. Like I did in the second night, third, fourth, fifth night. I still feel good when I'm with your people. Don't like to be up here particularly, but I feel good when I'm with your people. And I learn things. I listen. I sit there and listen. Folks, I'm not a bleeding deacon. I am not. I tell guys that I'm very close friends with in meetings that I sit in all the time, if you ever see me even begin to look like this description of a bleeding deacon in tradition 2 and the 12 and 12, you tell me right now. And I learn things. And I hear somebody tell me, I've been sober 42 years, and I hear somebody that's got 3 years say, you need a God box. The audacity of somebody telling me I need a God box. But let me tell you what I did the next day. Made a God box. First one I've ever made. Made a God box. That's what I go to meetings for. That's why I hang around here. That's why I learn about staying in tune with these steps that you people gave me to straighten out my life and have that spiritual experience or awakening that I'm promised I will have in step 12. Step 10 is a very vital step for me. I hope it is for you. Yesterday in the history of the big book, we talked about the fact that Bill had no ideas about step 10. There was nothing in the Oxford groups about that. God inspiring Bill put that step in there because Bill, as a real alcoholic, knew that I'd have trouble out there in the mainstream of life and I'd need something on a daily basis to get along with. And it says, and I'll paraphrase the first paragraph, it said, now comes the acid test. Can I stay sober, maintain emotional balance, and live to good purpose in fair weather or foul weather? What a profound statement for me. Because the caution there is that I might be at risk of not staying sober, not maintaining emotional balance, or not living to good purpose in both fair weather and foul weather. And I've been in both of those, folks, and I know what the application of step 10 is. I know what it is. There's been fair weather. There's been the corner office in the corporate office building. There's been the titles. There's been the decent income. There's been watching your children graduate from high school and from college. It's been leading a girl down the line, down the aisle and giving them to other guys. Fair weather. Then watching your grandchildren be born and come into this world. That's fair weather. Great day. It's been being assimilated into the community and the church and those things that I found to be important in my own recovery. Been important to me ever since. I went back to church next Sunday, and I've been going ever since. I'd be there now if it wasn't for being here. I sang for 8 years on a praise team in a contemporary service. I had Levi's older than the rest of those people that were singing. Amazing. Fair weather. I've had some fair weather. Retired from the insurance business, reasonably comfortable. Stayed married for all these years. Have done those things that typify fair weather. And I've been able to stay sober and maintain some emotional balance and live to good purpose. But there's been some foul weather too, folks. Been some foul weather. And I was thinking with that corner office and that title, there was three or four days when Bob and I experienced some foul weather when we went on airplane trip and we closed down four district offices and put friends that had worked with us for a long time out of work in 4 days. That's foul weather. It's foul weather when you learn that you're... second oldest granddaughter is autistic and will need special needs care. That's foul weather. It's foul weather when you need to kneel down in front of your mother and you say, "Ma, remember when you said you'd like to go into the Eastern Star home if you ever got to the point that you couldn't take care of yourself? Well, Ma, we go into a place like that today." And she nods her head and smiles because she doesn't understand what you said. And she trusts you and she has complete faith and trust in what you do. And you carry her there knowing she'll never come out. That's foul weather. Foul weather is when you lay on a carpet in your den all night long with your little dog who's in so much agony that she can't sleep. And in the morning, you take her and you put her in the right seat of the truck and you take her over to there and you leave her and you drive away. That's foul weather. Foul weather is when your oldest daughter tells you that after 27 years of marriage, there's going to be a divorce. Foul weather when you're considering what to do with Abby, the 18-year-old autistic girl who someday here shortly is going to have to go in a group home. That's foul weather. But you people give me the tools in this program to stay sober and maintain emotional balance and live to good purpose during those periods of time. I've gone through some challenges, some of those things in the last few weeks. And I'm going to tell you what I did. I did what I learned in the beginning, what I've learned over these few 24 hours I've been with you people. The first thing I did was that I got them on paper. In the four step in the 12 is 12, it doesn't say we're going to take a four step inventory one time. It says this is the beginning of a lifetime practice. So the inference is that I'll have to continue to take him. I'm glad of that because I can't sort these things out in my head. I got a busy head, folks. I got a lot of stuff going on. I'm busy. And these things get all mixed up there. I got to get them on paper. So 4 weeks ago, I did another inventory. I believe in inventories. I believe in inventories. If I sponsor you, or even if I don't, you got to understand that I believe in inventories. So I inventoried that, and I got 4 pages of resentments and 2 pages of fears. And I sat down with 2 people. One was my sponsor, and another was another spiritual advisor I got, and I went over that inventory with them. And I got some ideas on what to do with them. And I went home, and I was in a group where they were talking about step 6 and 7. Coincidence. So I thought, by golly. So the next morning, I went home, and I got out my 12 and 12, and I got out this inventory. And in addition to reading the 24-hour day book, which is that non-conference approved piece of trash that I've been reading. I've been reading for a long time. And in addition to the daily reflections, which I read every morning, read this morning, I've been going through that inventory. And I've been reading step 6 and 7 in its entirety in the 12 and 12, understanding more clearly, as it says in step 6, that this is a step that separates the men from the boys and the women from the girls. And then the seventh step, what humility is all about. And the basic ingredient is to seek and do God's will with these things. And it's self-centered fear is the chief activator of all my defects of character, he tells me in there. Tell him I'll call him back in about 5 minutes, I guess. And Bill tells me in there what I have to do with that. He tells me in there that since there the self-centered fear is the chief activator of all these things that appear on this inventory and that I've shared and that I've become willing to have removed, since self-centered fear, that my life is going to be uncomfortable and difficult because of unsatisfied demands that I'm making on people and things. And until I can find a way to reduce those demands through seeking God's help, I'm not going to be truly happy. And so I've been doing that every morning. For 2 weeks, I've been reading that 6 and 7 entirely. And I put together a new addendum prayer list that I'm using that deals only with these things on the inventory. This is an addition to my normal prayer list, which, you know, where I've got Barbara on there and Bob and Shirley and some of the people that I've been close to. But in addition to that, I've listed these things, and I pray for them. I prayed for them this morning that they would be removed and that I'd be able to give them to God humbly, and I'd let him take them and work them out. And if he needed me to do anything, let me know. And I've been doing that, and I've gotten rid of a lot of them. I've got them under wraps, a lot of them. Some of them I'm still doing business with. One of them is a physical condition that I'm dealing with. I got a replacement pacemaker several months ago, and I'm not entirely satisfied with its operation. And I can tell you that when your pacemaker ain't operating right, it lets you know it many times a day. It's not something you pray to have rid of in the morning and it goes, because you'll know when it ain't working exactly right. So I'm alerted to that. And I'm doing business, and that's on the inventory, that fear. And I'm asking God to help me deal with that. And it's working. It's working. I was in the church of my choice 2 weeks ago today, The minister alerted me to a piece in the book that they use there, that other book. And as Ken said, it was out of the book that Ann Smith mandated Bill and Bob and that she use in her morning devotion, the book of James. And it talks in there in the first few verses in here that I was alerted to that when I have difficulties and when life is going kind of tough, that's the time when I will grow. And that's the time I'll come out the other side a better person. You people have told me that all the time. And you said I can't pray to God with some sort of flip-flop guesswork, kind of don't know what's going to happen. Because if that happens, I'm going to get those kind of results. Kind of wishy-washy results. It ends up by saying, when I have faith, when I pray, then I'm going to get solid answers. So I've been doing that. Folks, life is pretty good. It's good to be here with you. You people have been good to me. Let me tell you this, that I am enthusiastic about the program. I sat in a meeting several months ago and I saw a girl who'd been in the program a while, and the meeting's about to start, Matthew's Wednesday night meeting, and the seats are taken up pretty well, open spot in the middle. They circle up, and she comes through the door with a new gal in her hand, leading her across that vacant spot to a couple of chairs that were vacant over here, the girl's first meeting. And I'm sitting there and I think, wow, that's what it's all about. Nothing happens until that happens. Nothing. Book says that. You won't miss that. I see guys in what I call the class of 06, 07, pick up, just guys I'm close to, pick up 1 and 2 year chips. And I've seen them pick up their first one. And I see that thing I look like on October 17, 1965. I know how I look. And I won't want to miss this. These are the great events that he talks about on page 164, if my relationship with him is right. That he will reveal more to me under two conditions: if I pray for the person who's still suffering, and if I keep my own house in order. Remember that gentleman, statute of limitations had run, and my records had been destroyed in a warehouse fire in St. Louis in the late 60s, but I had enough information so that I got tired of this guy's sponsor telling me, when you're going to fix that. And I got thinking maybe one of my grandsons might get a chance to go into academy or something, and they'd dig up some background, and they'd find this skeleton in the old man's closet that he hadn't cleaned up. So I went down to the VA, and I went on the internet, and I found out some stuff, and I got some information, and I put together a package and requested that they give me some relief under the statute of limitations, and that they use the information which I had put together as supporting information to change the conditions of my discharge. And let me tell you what I said in my letter. I said it all started to happen on October 17, 1965. And it's because of the power of you people and God that I understand today that I have a relationship with, that you permitted me to have that relationship with, that the vocational pursuit's been successful, that the community pursuit's been successful, that the family pursuit's been successful, that the deeper walk with God has been successful in these things in my life. And I sent that off to Randolph Air Force Base in San Antonio, Texas. And I kept getting copies of correspondence between the personnel division, the Air Force down there, and the Secretary of the Air Force, and the FBI, and some other people that had been involved, because there was clearance, there was top secret clearances involved and things of this nature. And I kept getting pieces of correspondence, and I didn't get any answers. And one day in the mail, I get a big envelope, and there's a letter on it. And it says, as I summarize it, we're pleased to tell you that because of what you told us, see, I gave AA all the credit, didn't take any, that we have changed all the information in your DD-214, and all of you that are military people know that that's a record of your military experience. Anything that referred to anything other than honorable has been changed to honorable. And that they were pleased to enclose a brand new honorable discharge. See, the general discharge that Bob saw in my military records was filed in back of the desk drawer. This one I got framed hanging on there. Great events will come to pass for you and countless others. Here's what they said in the letter. The reason that they had done all of this and were doing this was, one quote, my contribution to the community, end quote. So what I've been doing in my own personal recovery life, and what I've been doing trying to share with other people in the sponsorship role, and what I've been trying to do here in the last hour or so, and what I try to do every day, stumbling, is to try to continue that on, to make a contribution to the community. I hope maybe I've been able to do it this morning. I hope I'm able to do it for the rest of the day. And if I'm given a chance tomorrow, maybe I can make some sort of contribution to tomorrow. But if I do, it'll be because of you, not because of me. Thank you very much.